This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. You're listening to episode 101 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Good evening, Max.
Hello, David. Boy, we have a lot of content for tonight. I hope we can get it. We can fit it all in.
Yeah, it's not often that we can go around saying that we interviewed a princess, huh?
That's right. At the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, this is our second interview that we recorded for this podcast from the Innovations in Flight event on June 20th. So we've got that for you this episode. And we've got a few news stories as well, don't we, David?
We've got remote control passenger flights 5 years away, still volunteering to be one of those passengers. NASA is using their Akana and Global Hawk technology to test, sense, and avoid. Seattle police seek someone who flew a quadcopter into a crowd and knocked out a woman. Some video of the week, and we have some very interesting feedback, which, Max, I'm very proud of you because I didn't know how to answer this, but we'll get to that at the end.
Okay.
So I think we should get started. Our first topic comes from CNN. Remote-controlled passenger flights 5 years away, CEO says. The Aurora Flight Sciences Centaur was flown from Griffiths International Airport over the New York UAS test site. The Centaur is an optionally piloted aircraft, or an OPA, based on the Diamond DA-42 twin engine. Diamond tend to be are in the class of a general aviation trainer. The Diamond comes in multiple single engine and multiple engine. In this case, it was a DA-42. And it was the first large-scale fixed-wing unmanned aircraft to fly at an FAA-approved test site, unmanned.
Yeah, interesting milestone reached. The CEO of Aurora is John Langford. And in this article, he made some interesting comments. For one, he believes that unmanned aircraft will ultimately make aviation safer, and maybe not right away. And he admits that we'll likely see some incidents along the way. But he believes that unmanned aircraft will be safer. Of course, we know, David, that especially in the general aviation world, it's sort of plagued by a number of accidents and an accident rate that's kind of high. So he thinks that the unmanned versions of these aircraft might actually end up being a little safer than the piloted versions.
Ooh, we can't let our GA friends hear that.
I know. We'll have some pushback.
We'll have lots of pushback. It's an interesting thought that people are saying that the optionally piloted aircraft will be safer than a man-piloted aircraft. And who knows? It's a big milestone. The Diamond is a pretty neat aircraft. Mm. It's kind of sexy. I like it. And seeing the photographs of it without anybody in it is kind of, you sort of do a double take. You're like,
yeah, you do.
Yeah, there isn't anybody in there. Tend to do that when you use full-scale drones, you know, with the old F-4s and the F-16s and the F-106s. You always do a double check to check when they are showing it flying by itself.
And Aurora has a video on their website. We'll put a link to this in the show notes.
So, and maybe if anybody knows anybody from the Aurora Flight Sciences, give us a call, and we'd love to have you on the show. And let's talk about my favorite subject, NASA.
Mm.
NASA tests the Akana and Global Hawk technology. This was from flightglobal.com. NASA has one of the original, or two of the original Global Hawks, and they have a MQ-9, or a what they call a predator bee because it's civilian, but they named her Ikana. And General Atomics are using them to work on sense and void technology. Now, way back in the day, I interviewed the team at Langley that was doing the sense and avoid technology with two manned aircraft. Now we're up to using an unmanned aircraft and a manned aircraft.
Yeah, and in the month of June, they conducted a number of tests. What they did is have encounters between the Ikana and a beach King Air, and which acted as the intruder. And apparently all 23 encounters were successfully conducted. Now, this is a multi-phase testing program. There was actually some testing done last year. But this current phase of testing, it really includes two different things. One is testing, or rather validation, of sensor trajectory and some other simulation models with the Ikana. And then they will conduct additional tests using a Lockheed S-3B Viking that comes from NASA's Glenn Research Center. And that's going to act as a high-speed piloted surrogate aircraft. So they're kind of stepping it up with that Viking jet.
It's kind of nice that you see NASA Armstrong and NASA Glenn working together. It's a major step between a King Air and a Viking as far as speed goes. So it's an interesting progression that they're moving up to the next level to see how quickly someone will violate the UAV's airspace and how quickly it can react to it.
So those two stories, I think, David, those are examples of how the testing and the research is kind of stepping up when it comes to the developing the technologies that need to be developed. But our third news item here, it goes into the bad behavior files.
Your grounded files, as I like to call
them. Yes, yes.
During a parade in Seattle, a drone crashed into a building, then struck a woman who collapsed into her boyfriend's arms unconscious.
Yeah, bad news.
Dumb. Now, we have a lot of GA people who say, well, this is a prime example of what's going to bring down a GA aircraft. And unfortunately, we have to talk about these things where they found the drone, they turned it over to the police, and they took the data off of it, and they think they know who the pilot was because he took a droney.
Yeah, that's his, maybe I guess that's his bad mistake. But yeah, some of the eyewitnesses had descriptions of the guy they thought was the pilot, and they turned that over. We haven't had any definitive information about just exactly what this drone was, but it's described as costing about $1,200 and weighing about 2 pounds. David, I think we can probably guess what it might be.
You mean DJI Phantoms?
Well, just based on the statistical likelihood, I guess you could say that. There are a few very recent news stories, David, that I've seen on this that suggest that maybe the man who was flying this has contacted police. But we don't have really definitive information at this point. But I think, you know, the kind of the general tenor of the response from the unmanned community is that, you know, it's time to bring the hammer down. And this is maybe an example of a case where we need to do that, make an example out of somebody.
Nail his ass to the wall.
I was trying to be polite, but that's
no, it. I don't think we need to be polite anymore. We need to start up and work with these people. And when you do something stupid, there's going to be consequences, you know. And
right.
We don't need any bad press. And we got to keep in positive space. It was funny, one of the articles I didn't get a chance to put in, but someone sent us a link to a Florida statute where Tallahassee decided that the locals said that you could fly drones. It was sent to us with the thing, look, we can fly drones commercially in Florida. And I politely responded, only if you have a 333 certification from the FAA. The FAA has the bottom line rules, and they were a bit taken back. They're like, oh, I said, we need to keep educating people back and forth that, yeah, there's a lot of people doing a lot of things, but it not necessarily the right things. And the FAA has the bottom say. So we'll see if this Seattle issue gets transferred up to the FAA for action.
All right. Well, David, I think we better get moving along to our interview. Again, this is David and I speaking with Princess Alaya Pandolfi from the Kashmir World Foundation, who's doing some very interesting things with drones. And as we'll hear, maybe that's not the word that we want to use in all situations. But this is recorded June 20th at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum at the Udvar-Hazy Center, adjacent to Dulles in Northern Virginia. So why don't we listen to our interview with Alea Prandolfi. We're really excited to have with us Princess Alea Prandolfi, who is from the Kashmir World Foundation. In fact, you're the founder, are you?
Yes, I am.
Tell us about the foundation, what its goals are.
Well, Kashmir World Foundation is a nonprofit organization based in Great Falls, Virginia, and we focus on projects to help improve the world through innovative approaches, integrating art, science, and technology in our projects. So we focus on primarily wildlife projects, but education projects as well, which can help humans and wildlife live in harmony.
Now, on the UAV Digest, we talk about things like poaching and drones being used to kind of counter that. Now, this is a big part of what you're talking about, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
So tell us about how the foundation is working with that.
Well, 2 years ago, on July 1st, President Obama passed the executive order, and we launched the Wildlife Conservation UAV Challenge October 1st, which was pretty quickly, and it was an international challenge. We had no idea we were going to end up getting 140 teams from 30 different countries
Wow.
to compete in the challenge. And the challenge was focused on not just UAV, but primarily the sensors and the communication and the onboard processing that drones can provide in the ability to detect the poachers early on before they can actually kill, before they would actually hunt and kill the animals. So that was the goal of the project, and it's still ongoing. We do have our final stage, which would be the counter-poaching games, and that's where the top teams would meet us in South Africa mm-hmm. to demonstrate the ability of their UAVs and what they've developed in the last 2 years. And once again, it's not just we can launch our aircraft, we can fly it, but it will be focused more on doing a simulated poaching scenario and demonstrating the aircraft's ability to find those poachers, have the rangers on the ground, counter that once the data is received by the poachers.
So what you're saying is the drone will go up, find the poachers, and from what my understanding is, you look for things like campfires and campsites for where the poachers are hiding at night. What are the guidelines you use to find the poachers?
Well, we're not necessarily looking for the campfires. We're actually looking for the poachers. So that's where the sensors and the onboard processing is important. So we could do both day and night missions. And the goal would be to have a camera that first can detect, then characterize, and then determine if it is a ranger, a poacher, or an animal. So it's image processing is what we're mostly interested in, more so than the basic signals that they normally look for now when they're flying manned aircraft.
So are the teams using existing drones that are multi-copters or fixed wings? What kind of equipment are being used for
That's
this?
That's a really good question. So we went to South Africa, to Kruger National Park, to understand what they're up against, to have a real hand understanding of the terrain, the ranger's perspective, the officer's perspective, the military, the police force, and the Air Force. So we went there with a drone with us. We took Skate Aurora Flyance's aircraft, which is 2 pounds, back in 2013. And that gave us a really, really good understanding of what their needs would be. And it's not one type of aircraft that would solve all the problems. So we are focusing on two different types of aircraft so that the teams can determine if they want to compete in the strategic aircraft, which would require at least a 6 to 8 hour flight time, the ability to fly at night and carry the sensors that are necessary for night vision. And then the other option would be a more tactical aircraft that rangers can use to just launch with their hands. And ultimately, that would be a much smaller radius, let's say 5 to 7 mile radius, versus a strategic aircraft. We need it to be able to fly at least 50 to 70 miles in a pattern recognition type of format. And for that, we're developing a 12-foot aircraft, which is 3D printed, and it would have the ability to integrate all the new open source hardware technology that's available on the market as well.
So when you say we, that's the Kashmir World Foundation?
That's correct.
And how is the funding coming into the
So I self-funded the projects myself initially. Okay. So we are a nonprofit organization, but this is more of a passion project for me. And I love wildlife, and I like technology as well. And I figured the best marriage between the two would be to integrate technology to help protect the wildlife that I so much love. And luckily, I'm married to an aircraft designer as well.
Oh, very
handy,
so
that helps
huh?
me. And
who came first, the foundation or the aircraft designer?
So that's a good question. My husband actually started an organization called the Technology Assisted Counterpoaching Network back in the early 90s, and they were doing a lot of tiger protection at that time, and he provided the surveillance for tiger protection in Russia as well as India. And that network actually just grew from the 90s to include scientists and engineers and experts in the field that are focused on counterpoaching, security, surveillance, communication. So it's a pretty big network of people that do this as a passion because they love wildlife. So luckily, when I came along and I met my husband and we decided we were going to do work together on wildlife protection, I already had the basics that I needed, that strong foundation, and then the education and the ability to go out in the field and learn just kind of became a learning process for me. And I think I'm still learning about the technology, especially because it's changing so quickly. So the foundation did come in after, but before I met my husband. So I started a nonprofit in 2008, but I didn't meet him until 2009.
Okay, so do you get any pushback because you're using drones? I mean, we talk about drones. You use the drone word. But for a lot of people, that still has negative connotations because they think maybe of military drones. Do you find that when you're talking with people, introducing them to this concept and you use the drone word, do people jump back from that and you have to explain that this is a positive use?
So you're absolutely right. Depending on where in the world we are, the word drone can have a very, very negative connotation. And one of the reasons why we decided the name on the wildlife project we have, that's the international, it's called the Wildlife Conservation UAV Challenge, for that reason. Because in Africa, in South Africa, in many of these other countries, drones are perceived as killing machines.
Yes.
Even in the U.S., but I think one of the things we started, when we started the Da Vinci Challenge, I think having it called the Da Vinci Challenge Build a Drone Workshop, the Da Vinci kind of softens it early on.
Uh-huh.
So by the time they get to build a drone, it's so many letters later or words later that they're not necessarily looking at it from a negative perspective. That's just our take here. We haven't actually branched out internationally with the Da Vinci Challenge project yet, but that is on our list of things to do. And we might have to alter the name drone and or educate the groups we're working with in advance before we start marketing it as a drone word in there.
How about educating regulators? You know, one of the things that Max and I talk about on the show a lot is the FAA and 333 regulations. What are you finding, and assuming starting in South Africa, how are they receptive to the UAVs, and what kind of challenges do you have as far as regulation goes?
That's a big fight that I think everyone's fighting, and I see it on both sides from the FAA's perspective of just general safety, because we've seen a lot of mistakes that people make with toy drones.
Sure.
And the fact that people, you know, are excited about this new technology. It's exciting. It's innovative. So why not go ahead and try to do it? And then you look at the FAA. One of the problems that I think they are facing is most of the people on their team for regulation are ex-pilots. They don't necessarily understand unmanned systems and the autopilot. One of the requirements I know South Africa's worked on for their drone regulations is you have to have an RPA, remotely piloted
aircraft
license.
Yes.
But once again, you know, it's not the same as, well, we need to test your autopilot. Because I look at it as if I have to be tested, if I'm not flying my aircraft, my autopilot is flying it, I'm just setting the missions. You would have to understand that technology. And I think it's very important to have the FAA and any of these regulators involved in taking the courses that we're offering. And actually, we do work with the FAA. And I'm hoping that they're going to agree to sign up to one of our classes so they can have a much better understanding of what it is that they're writing these rules and regulations for.
Aaliyah, tell our listeners where they can learn more about the foundation and the activities that you're describing and how they can support what you're doing.
Well, they could definitely go to our website, which is www.kashmirworldfoundation.org. And all of our projects are listed on our website, but we do have a separate website for the Wildlife Conservation UAV Challenge, which is www.wcuavc.com. We teach our workshops at the Microsoft Store in Tyson's Corner, right down the street from here.
Right here in Virginia.
In Virginia. And we are actually doing our first workshop at the Crime Museum next month in Washington, D.C. And the reason we're doing that is because we just opened a wildlife trafficking exhibit where our organization provided the drone technology for the exhibit. So we had a lot of interest in the drones, and they asked if we would be willing to do a workshop at their location. So we would be offering that next month.
And just tell us a little bit about the workshop.
So the workshop, it's a really fun way of learning about drones and the technology, the uses of it. But most importantly, I think it's a great collaborative effort because we encourage parents and kids and teachers and students and husbands and wives, all ages, to work together on learning this new technology. Our youngest student has been 8. Our oldest was 80. So it's
everything
and anything
yes.
in between that.
Yeah.
But it's fun. You come into the class. You come with nothing. We start out by giving you the basic frame. And they put the frame together. They have two choices, whether they want to build a quadcopter or a hexacopter, decide for their team. And then, you know, they'll put the frame together, they'll add the motors on, and then they'll add the ESCs on and the autopilot. And as they add the different components, we'll do a lecture and educate them about those components and why we're using it for this particular kit. Because the goal is to give them the basic foundation that they need to understand unmanned systems. So the class focuses on that. We also introduce 3D printing to students because you can customize your drones afterwards. And we use some 3D printed plates to mount the avionics onto the aircraft as well. We do bring in guest speakers from the AMA as well as the FAA, 3D printing industry as well. So we're always looking for really good guest speakers that can come out and educate people about the industry from many different perspectives. And ultimately, day 4, they go out and they actually fly the aircraft, both with a transmitter as well as with a ground station such as Mission Planner or APM. So they're learning about flying autonomously and the encouragement of having someone on the transmitter, having someone monitor the elevation of the aircraft, the speed of the aircraft, and letting them set a geofence so therefore they know where they can fly, where they can't. And if they hit that geofence, the aircraft's going to come back and land home. And they can also set the geofence for altitude. One of the rules for flying as a hobbyist, they have to stay under 400 feet. So we work with them on educating them on the basics so they're in this nice, confined educational environment. So they're learning both the hobby of aircraft, they're learning aviation, they're learning flight, and then most importantly, how to integrate computer science with the world of aviation, because that will be the next phase for unmanned systems. And ultimately, hopefully giving students an opportunity to decide if this is a career they would want to go into, perhaps not aviation, but some component of it, because there's 3D printing, because there's computers, you can add a Raspberry Pi, a lot of our students, after they're done with a workshop, they add a Raspberry Pi and a Raspberry camera on it or any other type of little computer, and they can create different applications. We work with an all-girls boarding school in Middleburg, and they're developing an application to count the deer population on the 500 acres that Foxcroft owns.
Pretty
so
neat.
It's kind of really interesting and cool
to
give them the opportunity to create different applications with their drones as well.
Yeah, very good. All right, well, this is exciting stuff. You're doing great, interesting things. I can tell you really enjoy what you're doing. This is a great developing area, and we're just so pleased to have met you today and had this opportunity to talk with you.
And you'll come back and keep in touch, and hopefully we can tell more of the stories later on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, and I appreciate you guys doing this because I think it's so nice to be able to offer people the opportunity to learn about what many different organizations are doing to make this something that is useful versus the negative aspect of what it's been used in the past.
Yes.
And, I mean, we're sitting right here at the Air and Space Museum. Some of these aircrafts, for example, the one right behind me, is the one that was the big bomber for Hiroshima, Nagasaki. But it's here in a museum, and I think, you know, we're still at that phase right now with the UAVs or, you know, UASs or drones, whatever you want to call it, at the infancy. And all people know right now from the past is the military use. But now for commercial purposes, they have a lot of applications that I think that can benefit people versus hurt them.
That's right. And that's what the UAV Digest is all about. That's a big part of why David and I started this, was to sort of show people the positive elements, the positive aspects.
I got sick of every time the word drone showed up in a newspaper, it was a Predator firing a Hellfire missile. It was the same. Right? And it's kind of funny that in the 2 years we've done this, it's now a DJI Phantom that's ubiquitous in every newspaper article. But it does show the changes. But we want to promote the positive and the education. We've talked a lot recently about, you know, there are people who are dumb in there and there are people who are stupid. You know, the people are dumb, they don't know any better. And they're flying their quadcopter in the airspace around an airport because they don't know any better. And we got to minimize that over the people who aren't going to do bad things with it. But it sounds like an education program like you have is the right start. It gets everybody in a positive manner. It tells them the right way to fly, which is what we all want. We want all positive experiences. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you guys very much. I appreciate your time as well.
Well, Max, that was quite the honor and privilege, and very well spoken and really knowledgeable on UAVs. And what was your opinion about her comment about using the word drone in the United States and using the word UAS outside of it? I thought that was a very telling, out of the whole interview, that was one of the things that I came away very strongly with, that we still got a long way to go with the quote drone connotation, huh?
Yeah, that was one of my big takeaways as well, David. That we've kind of in the United States, well, at least some of us have kind of gotten beyond the D word as representing something evil or something associated with military activity, just by virtue of the fact that it's used in the press every day to represent something different. But in other parts of the world, that's not necessarily the case, and sometimes the connotation evokes a completely different kind of a reaction. So that was interesting. I also found it interesting what she's doing with sort of education and how she's conducting these educational sessions with people to help them understand what an unmanned vehicle is like and what the components are and how you build them and how you can use them. So that's that was a big takeaway as well.
You know, and I kind of wanted to say, when was the next class that you and I could jump in on?
I know.
If you're hearing this, we would love to be first participants in that, because I really think that both you and I could get a lot take away from being in that class, just because we know a lot, but there's a lot of details that we don't know and don't understand. The more I thought about it, it's like, yeah, you know, I really would like to be part of that class, just to have the tactile experience of building it from the ground up.
Yes, absolutely. So we'll put links in the show notes to the Kashmir World Foundation, the Wildlife Conservation UAV Challenge. And also, we found a fairly short video from National Geographic that describes the Wildlife Conservation UAV Challenge, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. Encourage you all to take a look at that.
And, of course, the show notes can be found at theuavdigest.com.
All right, some videos of the week, David.
We got more RP first-person view racing. This was from firstpersonviewracingtv.com. Time Trial Course 2. We also have another video called Sticks of the Mini Beast, which is a dramatic high-speed FPV flying. They get me kind of seasick, and I don't know. I hate to admit that because I usually have a pretty good stomach, but I'm going to chalk it up to the major surgery I've had in my life, and my balance is just not quite back to normal. But it is kind of amazing. The only thing I can equate it to is I harp back to Empire Strikes, to Return of the Jedi and the speeder bikes through the forest in California. So
yeah, the first one, David, is a lot like the multi-copter racing that I went to a few weekends ago, in terms of having obstacles that you need to navigate through. So that's a good view of what that looks like. And then that second video that you mentioned, David, it's interesting in that it's a, you know, like a picture-in-picture kind of view where you can watch the operator's hands on the controls, and then in a smaller window see the FPV view, what the quadcopter is seeing. It's fascinating to watch the stick movements, you know, and just how fast and how quick to react this pilot is. So yeah, it's very dramatic. We got another kind of a video. This came into us from our friend Tim Trott. This is about the Flytrex Sky, the first delivery drone. Flytrex is saying that this is the first internet-connected drone that serves as your personal courier. And the idea is that, like the package delivery videos that you might have seen from Amazon and others, the idea here is this is something that you can use on a personal level to bring you the pills that you forgot or, you know, whatever. Interesting. I don't know where this stands in terms of being actually an allowable activity, but we'll put the link in the show notes and you can kind of draw your own conclusions.
And of course, thanks, Tim, for keeping us up to date on your universe. And the next one was from Steve, who wrote into us, and I'm going to pretend to be Steve, and Max, you can pretend to be Max Flight, who answered his questions pretty comprehensively. Steve wrote in, I have some questions about how to get a UAV career started. I just discovered your podcast and have been trying to catch up with the past year's episodes while at work. Now, listening to podcasts at work is not very productive. Well, it's very productive, but not very constructive.
A lot of our listeners do that.
Yeah, including yours truly. Currently, he works in the biomedical equipment repair field, and he'd like a change. He asked a couple of questions, and besides Max's answers, we'd like to throw it out to the audience. And maybe you can provide us some feedback to feedback@theuavdigest.com, and we can help Steve along. Steve asks, how do you get trained as an operator in an industry that doesn't have a concrete set of rules? He found a place online that was asking over $3,000 for certification, but with no industry standards, how can it be accepted? He also found some schools back east, but he's looking for something in the Seattle area, which he lives. He purchased a small indoor quad that he'd been playing with, and I'm just finishing on building a small quad that I can practice with in the front yard. I figure I need to start somewhere, and that's as places where Max and I have started. And last but not least, and this was very telling, and Steve, you've actually thought this out, was I'm trying to figure out why a person should pay thousands of dollars for training when you can just buy a computer-controlled quads like the 3D robotics solo. I want to learn how to fly in solo mode and have a strong foundation. I'm just concerned that these smart UAVs are going to just water down the career market and make it too easy to be a so-called professional UAV operator. So, Max, take it away. What were your responses?
Well, these were just some of the things off the top of my head. I wrote back to Steve and said, the first thing is you need to become a skilled UAS pilot. For now, practice a lot, keep a logbook, And be sure that you vet any training schools before you go that route. As we know, this industry is very young. Things still need to settle down and sort out. So just be careful about spending a lot of money on a training school. You might want to think more about those that sort of lean towards general aviation, as opposed to those that are focused on drones, because you want that big picture. But that's one place to start. You've got to become a skilled pilot, no matter what kind of commercial operations you think you might get into. Eventually, you've got to be a good pilot, and you've got to understand aviation. Beyond that, if you have in mind providing some sorts of video services, well, then you need to become a skilled videographer. You can't just take an action cam and put it on a quadcopter and just start shooting videos. You really need to learn how to be a videographer. If you've got no background in that, you need to learn capture technique. You need to learn post-production skills. That's not always insignificant. So that's something that you can be focusing on. Also, if you're going to operate this as a business, you need to start thinking about appropriate insurance coverage. You need liability insurance. You may need other kinds of insurance. So start thinking about that. Start talking to those that provide insurance for these kinds of operations. Don't forget to take a look at that. And then you also are going to ultimately need to become certified by the FAA. And as Steve points out, we don't really know what that means. We have proposed regulations at this point. So my recommendation would be to treat the NPRM as if those are the regulations and then make your plans based around that. Of course, you've got to be somewhat flexible. You also should find ways to stay current with how these things are developing so that you can react and not get left behind.
And you can do that by listening to the UAV Digest every week.
Yeah, the setup for David, right? And then finally, and this is just in general, develop a business plan. You know, think about what services are you going to provide? Who are you going to provide them to? Who are your proposed customers? Estimate what your expenses would be. Take a look at the profit margins that you want to achieve. What are the prices that the market is willing to pay? Estimate any of those elements that you can't determine absolutely, and that's probably going to be a lot of them right now. And then just do some sensitivity analysis around those. But that's some of the sort of the general advice. Those of you listening might have some things that are can be added to this, things that I hadn't thought of. And so we invite you to do that.
And of course, you can send that to feedback@theuavdigest.com. And I don't have anything to add other than, Max, that was a pretty comprehensive answer for Steve. So, Steve, definitely please keep us posted on your progress. And we want to follow through. And like our listeners, if there's anybody else who has any suggestions, please definitely, we're here to develop a community, just like we've done on Airplane Geeks. And that's one of those things that we're all here to help each other. So let's, looking forward to having lots of answers this week on helping Steve. And we'll publish those and talk about them next week. So I guess at this point, we're sort of running long, aren't we, Max?
Yes, we are. So let's wrap it up. I want to thank you all for listening to episode 101 of the UAV Digest. As David said, find us at theuavdigest.com. Show notes you can get to directly at theuavdigest.com/101.
And of course, if you'd like to support us, you can do that multiple ways. One is leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher.com. You could purchase some swag at our Cafe Press store, or you can become a patron to the show at our Patreon account. And of course, we have our social media presence, which is Twitter at UAV Digest and Facebook.com/UAV Digest. So with that, I'm going to say it's David in Philly
and Max in Hartford.
Thank you so much for listening.